Our next speaker is Tony Harrigan, who is Executive Vice President of the United States Industrial Council. He's the author of 7 books, hundreds of articles, and is familiar to many of you who participated in conservative affairs as a lecturer on economic issues, national defense, and foreign affairs. He's vigorous and uncompromising in his defense of freedom and free enterprise, and I'm sure that the paper he's going to present today will be both illuminating and challenging. Mr. Harrigan.
Ladies and gentlemen, as the United States marks its bicentennial, it is of crucial importance that Americans understand the threats developing in the world. Only as they comprehend the new dangers will they be able to discern the foreign and military policies necessary to protect the Republic. While Soviet armed might will remain the principal threat to the United States, new threats are emerging, threats which the U.S. public only dimly perceives. The change in the global balance of power emerged in dramatic form when the oil-producing nations of the Middle East employed an embargo, a weapon of economic warfare. In the short time since then, the United States and other industrialized Western nations, including Japan, have come to appreciate the new importance of the oil states. 2 of those states, Saudi Arabia and Iran, have graduated from the ranks of third world nations and set forth on the road to industrialization in the Western pattern. At the same time, the weakness of some of the older states of Europe has been cruelly exposed. Even as the Persian Gulf oil states were gaining new status, the United States was turning away from the role of global policeman, which adopted in the years after World War II. The United States went through the traumatic experience of withdrawal from Southeast Asia, and the exact lines of its strategic frontier in the Western Pacific have yet to be determined. In some ways, too much has been made of the American withdrawal from Southeast Asia. Some writers have presented the retreat from Indochina almost as the end of the Western world. Yet the U.S. departure from Vietnam did not constitute an American Dien Bien Phu. U.S. power remained intact. To be sure, the withdrawal represented for the United States a partial failure of nerve and understanding, a triumph of radical media politics over national interests, and a demonstration of the unwillingness of the American people to support a truly protracted struggle under guerrilla subversive war conditions. For the time being, the American people display a very cautious mood insofar as foreign policy is concerned. They clearly view with disfavor any suggestion of new military ventures in remote regions, except in very special circumstances where national pride and interest are combined, as in the Mayaguez incident. It would be a mistake, however, to describe the current mood as an enduring one. The shape of the American future is uncertain, including the shape of public opinion. Charles Scotti, writing in Foreign Policy, shrewdly noted, and I quote, "The American public has in the past rather consistently fluctuated between periods of under-involvement and over-involvement, and it is hard to say what combination of international, domestic, political, and economic events may prompt a sudden reversal of opinion, or indeed how long the prevailing mood of sulky aloofness may last." Thoughtful citizens are attempting to define the new limits of U.S. foreign and military policy. They pose these questions: what should move Americans and their government? What are the nation's truly vital security interests? What areas and situations justify deployment of armed forces? Obviously, the old answers will not do. Now, in searching for adequate answers, one can begin by recognizing that economic concerns play a large part in the current thinking of the American people. Irrespective of political orientation along conservative or liberal lines, Americans display increasing reluctance to favor armed intervention abroad on the grounds of defensive freedom, old alliance commitments, or appeals to national liberation. This attitude cuts both ways, affecting the favored objectives in years past of both conservatives and liberals. On the other hand, it seems equally clear that bold action to protect America's economic interests constitutes one of the few forms of action not depreciated by the U.S. public. The central fact of this period is the concern Americans feel with regard to their economic security, including the nation's access to essential imported oil and critical minerals. The American people are mindful of the perils facing their economy. This awareness engenders, among other things, concern for the unhindered movement of oil at sea and the protection of offshore drilling and mining. It also dictates limits on offensive action overseas, which would impose severe stresses on the national treasury. These attitudes should not be dismissed as evidence of a revival of old-style isolationism. And if anything, Americans are increasingly aware that what happens in a remote part of the world has an impact on the United States. But Americans today are less inclined to be emotionally or ideologically committed to faraway lands and causes. The enthusiasms of the 40s, 50s, and 60s have cooled. Americans have paid enough for crusades in blood and money and are now more selective in their appeals for U.S. action abroad. We have a chastened, perhaps even a wiser nation in this respect. This is not to say that we don't have advocates of renewed international adventurism who urge, indeed insist, that the United States in company with other advanced nations must redistribute a large part of its wealth to nations in the third world. Harlan Cleveland, former diplomat, is typical of the element that is calling for global fairness, a revolution, Mr. Cleveland's phrase. In a recent speech, Mr. Cleveland insisted that the U.S. share its wealth in the name of redistributive justice, or, quote, soon we will see the tides of expectation and resentment rise up around us. This kind of scare talk, which suggests that the U.S. owes a moral debt to violent, unstable third world countries, indicates where the foes of a realistic foreign policy will stand in the period ahead. It also serves to remind Americans that a serious challenge is being posed by reckless regimes on the southern continents. The demagoguery displayed in the United Nations, with the burning antagonism of retarded proletarian states towards the United States, the European Community, and Japan, indicates the realities of violent feeling and actual violence with which the West will have to deal in the remaining years of this century. Jeffrey Barraclough, writing in the New York Review of Books, asserted that we are witnessing a fundamental confrontation between the poor nations and the rich. He charged that what the Western nations, particularly the United States, fear is the loss of the power and leverage they wielded in the past and of the affluence they helped to create and sustain. No American need feel ashamed of a determination to maintain U.S. power and leverage. The good life Americans enjoy is the fruit of generations of hard work by our people. Other less talented and less energetic people want to take it away in the name of redistributive justice, international class warfare, or whatever. The need simply is for Americans to be realistic about the struggle and to press for every advantage. Many of the third world countries which want to share in a redistribution of Western wealth are limited today in their military options against the Western world, limited to terrorism, harassment, and subversive warfare. On the other hand, India, despite its grinding poverty, which seems beyond solution, has exploded a nuclear device. Robert Heilbronner has warned that major underdeveloped nations may use small nuclear capabilities as an instrument of blackmail to force the developed world to transfer large amounts of wealth to the poverty-stricken world. And Professor David von Prague of Carleton University in Canada has given a more explicit warning in connection with India. Writing in Asian Affairs, he said, by the end of the decade, will India be pointing its ICBMs in the general direction of wheat fields of Kansas and Saskatchewan and say, give or else? The prospect is not fantastic, end quote. Such predictions make sense when one bears in mind that much of the world is entering a time of famine or near famine. Smith Hempstone has said that historians of the future will remember 1975 as the first year of the big hunger. Initially, he said it will cost the lives of perhaps 20 million people. Food, in short, is a powerful weapon in the American arsenal, and before many years, food may become America's most important weapon. It is essential Americans regard food as a part of their security equipment. It is essential because the U.S. is resource deficient in other areas and must take advantage of every bargaining chip. The United States imports some 100 minerals, at least half of which have important uses. Vice Admiral John Lee has pointed out, and I quote, the key resource areas of central importance to us for mineral imports are reasonably concentrated in the Western Hemisphere,
Canada, Mexico, Brazil, Jamaica, the north coast of South America, southern Africa, Australia. The danger is that Marxist forces will become established in many of these areas. Now, given the situation, a growing need for resources located in the southern hemisphere, and an environment of increasing hostility, the United States has a requirement for a new strategy. This is what is best described as a resource control strategy. Admiral Will discussed such a strategy in an address to the Naval War College in 1974, saying, and I quote, "The premise of the concept called resource control is that shortages of resource supply will replace shortages of demand as the dominant force in world economics. If that premise is true, access to or availability of and the ability to move essential resources will become the central objective of the strategic equation. This viewpoint implies that as the resource problem develops, the primary military task after physical defense of the homeland will be to support access to needed resources against constraints, interruptions, or denials, whether imposed by military force, by governmental actions, or by economic effects. It could include denial of resources to hostile states," end quote. This analysis strikes me as correct. Defense of the homeland remains the primary U.S. strategic military task, and for that purpose, the United States has need of superiority in nuclear armaments and in the new laser weapons. The second phase of America's defense now involves resource control rather than alliance support. In an era of energy shortages and threatening mineral shortages, old allies such as Italy and Greece aren't as significant as assured access to resources available from Iran and South Africa, for example. In a resource-deficient era, the United States inevitably will be less Eurocentric in its views, and the fringe states of Asia also will diminish in importance to us. It is essential that Americans consider these new perspectives. The Mediterranean world, long a focus of American defensive strategy, is not a resource access area. At the time the NATO alliance came into being, the Mediterranean Sea was a vital waterway for the West. Today, the tanker traffic from the Persian Gulf moves around the southern tip of Africa. The overall significance of this enclosed sea, the Mediterranean, has vastly diminished. Yet U.S. foreign and military policies take scant note of the changed situation in a quarter century. Clearly, there will be tremendous resistance to change. The supranationalists who caused the United States to make so many mistakes in the post-World War II world, including the creation of a vast array of incapable synthetic states, are still with us. Having urged appeasement of communism over a period of many years, they now propose that the United States capitulate economically to the third world nations created through their influence. Yielding to third world demands has been recommended most explicitly by Secretary of State Kissinger, who told the underdeveloped nations in an address in Wisconsin last July, quote, "We are prepared to undertake joint efforts to alleviate your economic problems." He declared, quote, "If the industrial world wants to overcome the attitude of confrontation between nations, it must offer equitable solutions for the problems of the less fortunate parts of the world." Dr. Kissinger persists in saying that allies and adversaries, new nations and old, rich and poor, are part of a world community. He asserts, quote, "that our interdependence on this planet is becoming the central fact of our diplomacy." All the evidence is to the contrary. There is less community now than in the 40s or 50s. The gap between the advanced nations of the West and the proletarian nations of Afro-Asia, for example, is greater than ever before. Throughout the underdeveloped world, terrorist groups flourish and dominate politics. With few exceptions, the countries of the third world are impossible partners for free world nations, elements that cannot be assimilated in a law-abiding, reason-respecting international community. Beyond the third world, there is the unyielding mass of communism. Indeed, Soviet Russia and communist China clearly reject by deeds at home and abroad the idea of interdependence which Dr. Kissinger tries to sell to Americans. The beginning of wisdom in the conduct of our foreign and military policy is a clear recognition that as far as one can see, there is no hope of a worldwide community, no gain to be achieved for the United States by a further sharing of resources, no hope of establishing in our time a global community of free, independent, and cooperative nations. The U.S. has need of a realistic vision which takes note of the very narrow circle of genuinely free nations or nations which have a strong interest in associating themselves with America. The United States must pinpoint those countries essential to America's security and concentrate diplomatic efforts on strengthening ties within that limited circle. In the main, these will be countries that subscribe to capitalism and have natural resources or industrial capabilities that make them important and ensure a solid future. For example, among the most important countries for the United States today are Canada, Brazil, Iran, South Africa, Saudi Arabia, Japan, and West Germany. These are the powerhouses of the future. These are the nations with oil, gold, uranium, strategic location, industrial know-how, and the capacity for effective military action in concert with the United States. In calculating the strategic global balance, the United States can afford to, quote, lose countries such as Colombia, Ceylon, Kenya, and even such old allies as Turkey and the Philippines. But it cannot afford to be without access to the new strength offered by such countries as Iran and Brazil, for example. The oil of the former and the minerals and agricultural potential of the latter make those nations increasingly important factors in our time. For as far into the future as anyone can discern, Soviet Russia and Communist China will pose an enormous threat to America and to the civilization of which it is a part. The United States needs to add to its strength by forging judicious links with other capable nations instead of engaging in an orgy of guilt feelings about incapable and frequently hostile states. The bicentennial offers Americans an opportunity to appraise their nation's power position and the policies designed to safeguard it. Indeed, reappraisal is a necessity as America's power position deteriorates. The United States has great strength despite extraordinary setbacks and appalling mistakes in policymaking which have thrown away many American advantages. The special danger in this year is that the United States will continue to make concessions to the Soviet Union in arms agreements and at the same time will begin to divest itself anew of wealth and power in its dealing with arrogant third world nations. It is vital that the American people become aware of this danger and turn away from a defeatist foreign policy in order to fashion strong ties with a select group of reliable states with the means and the will to survive. Thank you.